I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to begin an important conversation about poverty in America, in Indiana, and in Indianapolis. It's called Chasing the Dream. We'll explore the reasons poverty rates in Marion County and elsewhere have exploded in recent years. My guests are Catherine Byers, former co-director of the Institute for Family and Social Responsibility at Indiana University, and Kelsey Clayton, manager of the Indiana Assets and Opportunity Network. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Email is nolimits@wfyi.org. Facebook is nolimitswfyi. Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to begin an important conversation today on No Limits called Chasing the Dream. It's really an exploration of poverty in America, poverty in Indiana, poverty in Indianapolis and Marion County. If you would like to join this conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Catherine Byers, who is retired from the Indiana University School of Social Work and is former co-director of the Institute for Family and Social Responsibility at Indiana University, and Kelsey Clayton, who is manager of the Indiana Assets and Opportunity Network. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
It's good to have you both here. So we probably ought to start the premise. One of the reasons we are exploring this topic right now is we're at the 20th anniversary of the welfare reform of the 1990s that fundamentally changed the way we approached poverty in this country, at least through government services. As a premise for the discussion, we probably ought to start by talking about what welfare reform was, what it did, what changes it brought about. Catherine, I'm going to start with you on that one.
Welfare reform, as Clinton said, it was to end welfare as we know it, and it did end certain aspects of welfare. Welfare reform was never designed to reduce poverty, and I think we need to be very clear about that. Welfare reform was designed to decrease caseloads and decrease the amount of money that government was spending on helping people who were struggling. One of the primary changes that happened is that eligibility for welfare has time limits now, 2-year time limits. And that meant that people in 1996 had to get off of welfare over a period of time. And the rolls did reduce significantly. In Indiana, about 80% reduction in the rolls. That didn't mean that the people who left welfare were suddenly wealthy or had more assets. In fact, we saw an increase in what we would call extreme poverty, people who had very, very little to live on. It's also important to point out that welfare reform started at the time of an economic boom in this country. There were people who were able to leave welfare for work and get jobs, not necessarily well-paying jobs, but at least to get jobs. So that, I think, was, to me, the primary change that we saw in welfare reform.
We probably ought to talk a little bit about the motivation for changing it, too, that it wasn't designed to combat poverty directly, but it was tied into that, too. There was a sense at the time that welfare, to use President Clinton's phrase, as we knew it, was in some ways enabling poverty or creating a dependency that we could not break. What were the arguments at that time in favor of attacking the welfare system as it existed up to that point? Attacking is probably not the right word.
Well, but, no, yeah. It probably is the right okay. word. I think that many people had the perception that women, and I think it's important to point out, we're talking about women and children when we talk about welfare, that women were, quote unquote, taking advantage of the system and that they were staying on welfare in order to not work and to sit around and watch soap operas and eat bonbons.
Yeah, that was the cliche.
In fact, before welfare reform, the average stay on welfare was 2 years. Mm-hmm. So, in fact, for the majority of people who were on welfare, they were using it as a temporary way to get by during a rough economic time. And so what happened, though, is, and what we found in our research, is that a number of the people who were on welfare were not really employable, mm-hmm. either because of low educational attainment, their own disabilities that weren't necessarily diagnosed, or they were caring for a child or some other family member with a disability. And so they were providing this caretaker role, and that was what they were, in a sense, doing. But the public's perception was different from the reality of the people who were on public assistance programs.
Kelsey, in this post-welfare reform world in which we live in, what have the implications been for the poor, for people who live in poverty?
Sure. I think measuring the standard of living has changed over the years, such as the family structure, the role of women, the ethnic profile of our population, financial and employment risk and educational attainment. I mean, they all kind of factor into the overall story of, economic progress. With the Indiana Assets and Opportunity Network, we work to build assets for low-wealth Hoosiers, and we help build capacity for programs, the social services programs around the state to help get those folks to help them move up the economic ladder. So that's workforce development. That is getting, incentivized savings programs, into the hands of these working families.
If you are just joining us, we are beginning a prolonged conversation about poverty in America, Indiana, and Indianapolis. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. So we've seen, in terms of just the sheer numbers, in the 20 years, what have we seen happen to the poverty rates? Let's go with America first, but then drill down to Indiana and central Indiana, if possible. Catherine, I'll start with you on that one.
Poverty rates have not changed dramatically over this, at least the last 10 years. I didn't look back 20 years, but the last 10 years, the poverty rate hasn't moved a lot. It's, bumped around a little bit, but it hasn't moved a lot. We are seeing an increase in the number of people who are using food stamps, who are accessing the earned income tax credit, which helps people who have lower incomes, and the number of children who are on the free and reduced lunch programs. And all of those are measures of need that show us that in some cases, it may be that people are finding out about programs that they can use and qualify for. That's particularly true with the earned income tax credit, that not everyone who was qualified for it knew about it. And there have been some really good efforts to publicize that more so that people can take advantage of that in a positive way, take advantage of that mm-hmm. program, just as all of us would like to take advantage of things that we can claim on our taxes. So I think that what that demonstrates is there still are huge numbers of people in need. In Indiana, what astounds me is that 1 in 5 children are under the poverty level. And that has huge implications for child development and long-term productivity. If you're not getting enough to eat as a child, if you're not, you know, maybe getting to school because you don't have shoes or a warm winter coat, then that child's long-term prospects are going to be diminished. And so we need to think about making sure that all of the children in our state and in our nation have access to the resources that they need to develop.
Mm-hmm. Kelsey, if I'm sensing this, the poverty rates have stayed pretty much constant then since when the economy began to slow down.
Yes.
2000s.
Right.
And, you know, in some ways the stock market is at almost three times the peak that it you know, the point it was at its low point in early 2009 when I think it dipped to 6,600, and now we flirt somewhere 17 and 18 on either side of that. But we haven't seen that lift at the bottom end of the spectrum. How many people does your organization or network have to serve? I mean, how many people now? And when have there been spikes in the demand for your services? Or
so we do indirect service. So we do build capacity for direct service organizations. But there's a million people in Indiana that are in the poverty level. So we build resources to help them overcome basically just meet their self-sufficiency standard. Even from 2000, the median household income in Indiana was $55,000, and in 2013 was dropped to $47,000. So we know that wages are low. A college attainment is absolutely essential to walking up the economic ladder. But there's those middle skills jobs that are paying low that need to, we need to find jobs for individuals that can really, they can work a 40-hour work week and not need other resources or another job to really meet their basic needs.
So in some ways, the jobs numbers we see, it's a rare day in which particularly elected officials who currently hold office aren't sending out some pronouncement saying more Hoosiers than are working now than at any time in the state's history, all of that sort of stuff. Those jobs aren't necessarily, though, solving the poverty problem. You're both shaking your heads. I'm going to go with Kelsey, but I want to hear both of your thoughts on this.
Yeah, absolutely. Those jobs numbers do look really good for the state, but it's many individuals have to work multiple jobs just to make ends meet. And that's, transportation costs are high, housing, affordable housing costs are high. There's childcare that unaffordable childcare as well. There's a lot of factors that come into an individual just getting by. And these jobs just aren't quite cutting it in the state.
Just to piggyback on that, to give you examples, 52% of fast food workers use some benefit, either TANF, food stamps, earned income tax credit, Medicaid. 48% of home care workers use some benefit in order to try to meet needs. And 46% of child care workers use some benefit. So all of these folks are people who are working full-time, have a full-time job, but still aren't able to meet their basic needs, and they qualify for Medicaid, food stamps, earned income tax credit, or welfare. So I think that illustrates what Kelsey has just said, that yes, we have jobs, but they don't pay enough for people to meet their basic needs, to be self-sufficient in many cases.
Is this the other question we have to ask, is this a temporary problem? Or, Catherine, you're shaking your head. I'm not even going to go with the rest of the question.
No, it's more than temporary. It's a realignment of our economy, that the manufacturing jobs that used to be those family-supporting jobs that people have left. And Bloomington is a good example. We used to have an RCA plant, Otis Elevator, General Electric. We built televisions, those jobs don't exist anymore in Bloomington. And we have high-paying jobs, and then we have low-paying social, you know, service sector jobs, and not much in that in-between layer that Kelsey was talking about, that are the kind of jobs that people need to support a family.
And that, I think, is something we're going to want to talk about. Is that I know the economists refer to this as the development of the hourglass economy, with big ends at big bulges at both ends and not a whole lot in the middle. If you're just joining us, we are talking about poverty. It's part of an ongoing discussion called Chasing the Dream. My guests are Catherine Byers, who's the former co-director of the Institute for Family and Social Responsibility at IU, and Kelsey Clayton, who's manager of the Indiana Assets and Opportunity Network. I am John Krault. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are beginning on this program our part of a larger national conversation that WFYI is part of called Chasing the Dream, Poverty and Opportunity in America. And we're going to be doing at least three more shows on this. We know definitely we're going to be doing shows on June 16th, June 21st, and June 28th. My guests are Catherine Byers, who is retired from the IU School of Social Work and is the former director of the Institute for Family and Social Responsibility at Indiana University, and Kelsey Clayton, who is manager of the Indiana Assets and Opportunity Network. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Megan has done, and reach out to us via Facebook. You can find us there at No Limits WFYI. Megan says, is someone coming from the middle class understanding what poverty looks like maybe more difficult for me than I'd like to believe? Can you share with me what poverty looks like here in Indiana? We hear income levels and unemployment numbers, but I think it would be interesting and helpful for me to understand what being below the poverty level means for someone. Thanks. Kelsey, I'll start with you on that one.
Sure. Thanks for the question, Megan. Thinking about, say, an individual working at Starbucks, for instance, single mother, you know, there are benefits, actually, that they give at Starbucks. But juggling, you know, that schedule, there's an issue with scheduling for those service jobs that a worker may be there for 8 hours and then need to come back, you know, 4 hours later. Juggling, you know, their family life, transportation, and any sort of education kind of wrapped up into that kind of goes to the wayside, or they have to, it's harder, it's stressful. You know, when we think about breaking down these barriers to, you know, self-sufficiency, it's creating policies and systems that work for families that, you know, want to move up that ladder again. You know, thinking about, you know, the economic health should be viewed as an overall community health. So it's very much meeting those basic needs of, you know, if it is just the minimum wage of $7.25 in Indiana, thinking that you have to pay for your groceries and, you know, afford housing. There's just a lot of pieces that don't wrap up into that overall income for the year.
We've gotten another question via Twitter. If you want to find us via Twitter, you can do so at WFYI. This is from a listener named Clyde. It says, if poverty rates have increased and voter participation rates have decreased since 2000, what does that say about education policy emphasis on testing? Catherine, I'll throw that one your way.
Well, let me make the connection between the poverty rates and voting participation.
Okay.
One of the things that we do know is that people with higher incomes vote with more frequency. And part of that has to do with what Kelsey just mentioned in terms of the balancing act of workers who work jobs where if you take off you either lose pay or that comes out of your sick time or personal time. And so voting in Indiana with our 6 to 6 voting hours becomes a challenge unless you're in a place where you can do early voting and or vote on a Saturday. So sometimes our voting rules and laws don't really facilitate people with low-wage jobs being able to participate. And we do know that politicians listen to the people who vote. And so it's more likely that they're going to pay attention to higher-income voters because they're more, you know, proportionally more of them than lower-income voters. I'm not sure about the connection with test scores. I do think that we have an overemphasis in this state and in the country in general on testing per se. To me, education is all about learning to think and learning how to access resources, the quote-unquote facts I learned in grade school. Some of them are no longer considered facts. And so to spend a lot of time memorizing that doesn't make a lot of sense to me. But it is important to know how to find information and how to use that information critically to make decisions. And that's not always something that we test for in our public school system.
We are talking about poverty and opportunity here as part of a conversation called Chasing the Dream on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Ron has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Ron, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, John.
Certainly.
Enjoying the conversation, although it is deja vu all over again. I don't know how many times we've heard this conversation in various medias. This was forewarned, this whole problem that we have in this country economically, by Ross Perot, the giant sucking sound, if you remember, and all the unions in this country foretold of the same thing, that shape that we are in today. And the business leaders, they want to say, well, you know, it's an uneducated workforce. We need more training before the jobs can come back. That's just baloney. I work in a factory. I see the young people coming in. All it requires is for somebody with maybe a high school education, and they can step right in and start doing the job if they apply themselves. Higher education for the manufacturing jobs that left this country are not the answer. I mean, you consider they took those jobs, sent them to foreign countries, and all of a sudden the unskilled labor in those foreign countries can do the jobs. That should tell us something right there. Now, the answer to all this, and I hope this doesn't void the need for the 3 more programs about the subject that you were talking about, but it's up to the voters. I see no other way around it. Hopefully California is listening. You got Donald Trump, who was born with a silver spoon in his mouth, who says the wages of American workers are already too high. You've got Hillary Clinton, who is going to be business as usual, has been demonstrated by all the money that she's gotten received for her campaign. The only one left who is saying anything out of the ordinary and has been for years and years is Bernie Sanders. I mean, we had NAFTA, and now we have the Asian Trade Pact. That can't make anything any better. Go Bernie. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling, Ron.
Yep, bye.
Bye-bye. So in terms of this, and I'm going to skirt away from, you know, dealing with endorsements of political candidates one way or another, but I do think that there is an important point here that Ron is alluding to, which deals with sort of the development of this hourglass economy and all of this. And that is a kind of, for lack of a better term, breaking of the social contract, the implied social contract, which, you know, said in, I'm going to really grossly oversimplify this, that if you work hard, you play by the rules, there's going to be a good life for you. And at least what I'm hearing from both of you is there are an awful lot of people working really, really hard, playing by the rules, and there isn't really a good life for them. Catherine, you're nodding your head. What are the implications of that long term for us if people feel like if they don't play by the if they play by the rules, they're still not going to get ahead?
I think we're seeing some of that in the frustration that people are expressing in the political system, the anger, and some of the blaming of other people for their circumstances. And I think the outrage is justified, that people it is harder to play by the rules and to get that good life. For many people in this country. I don't think we need to blame other groups of people for that. I think there are global economic forces that have created that hourglass or creating that hourglass economy, and it's much harder for us to figure out how do we challenge those kinds of forces? How do we make sure that companies don't keep their assets overseas and therefore avoid taxation. We're seeing more and more, for example, more and more of our federal government dollars are coming from individuals instead of corporations, because corporations have found ways to protect their assets in many ways. So I think we're seeing that kind of frustration play out in some of the dynamics of this election. Unfortunately.
Well, and Kelsey, I'm thinking in the populations that you serve, I mean, that's got to be a tremendous source of frustration that again, even if you do what you're supposed to do, and by most of the standards that we've used through our history, you have some success, you still don't necessarily get the job done, don't achieve your goal.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there was a recent study by the National Low Income Housing Coalition. It's called the Out of Reach Report, and it shows how an individual to afford a 2-bedroom fair market rate apartment at $772 a month has to get an hour wage of $14.84. And knowing that our minimum wage is half of that, they would have to work 2 full time jobs to afford that apartment at 30% of their total income. So we know that there are these systems that in place that are creating barriers to this economic or equitable society in our state. You know, we see it outside of just housing. You know, it's affordable childcare. It's reliable transportation around Indianapolis and urban and rural areas throughout the state. You know, there are issues that we haven't combated yet.
Gotten an email from a listener named Jerry, and if you'd like to reach out to us by email, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Jerry says, as I listen, I haven't heard anyone addressing the root cause, only the symptoms. There are many causes, each of which is a topic in itself. Too many people, inadequate education, ignorance.
As causes of poverty?
Yes.
Well, I would say that There's a much longer list of the causes of poverty. Low wages, as Kelsey indicated. You know, it's very hard to get ahead if you're working a minimum wage job. Divorce has a huge impact on women. That you see income dramatically drop for women after a divorce. Low educational attainment, and sometimes that is related to the cost of higher education. And the indebtedness that students have to go into. In many communities, lack of jobs that match the skills that people in that community have. People have disability and health issues. It's very hard to qualify for disability through the Social Security system. You have to be really, really disabled. So if you have a disability or a chronic kind of health issue that makes it hard for you to work a full-time job, that can lead to poverty. If you have caretaking responsibilities of a child or a spouse, Kelsey mentioned child care. When the poverty, the way we figure poverty, when that was first enacted, we didn't factor in child care. Mm-hmm. As part of that, because we had quote unquote stay-at-home moms. Now, single parent families never had that. But So we didn't factor in the cost of childcare. Some childcare costs more than sending a child to college. So we need to factor that in when we think about these low-wage jobs. People have mental health issues and addiction issues that sometimes keep them from full-time employment. We have people who become poor because of medical bankruptcies. Medical costs are the highest, the most common reason that people file for bankruptcy today. Medical costs, out of control medical bills. And then I think it's very important to remember that we still have discrimination in this country, wage discrimination for women, for people who have African-American descent, and for Hispanic people. That sometimes it's the jobs that people are qualified for, but women still earn, what, 72 cents or something for every dollar that men earn. So it's hard for certain groups of people to get ahead. And so there are multiple causes for poverty. Some of them may be located within the individual, but many of them are systemic barriers. And we have to tackle all of those in order to reduce poverty.
We are talking about poverty and opportunity here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. Benjamin, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hello. What's on your mind?
Just had a question and a comment. Something I haven't really heard discussed yet, and that is, and I don't want to sound like a conspiracy theorist or anything, but the value of a dollar used to be a dollar, and now it's about 3 cents. And how does that affect any type of wage growth or what people can afford? And when people try to buy goods and services, I know that they say, well, the cost of living isn't going up, but that doesn't include everything anymore, it seems like. So how does that really affect, and what can we do to change that?
Thanks very much for the call and the question, Benjamin. Kelsey, I'll start with you on that one.
You know, I haven't really thought about the 3 cents to the dollar, honestly.
Well, it's also, the very nature sort of currency and income and all of that is changing with an evolving economy, too. I mean, there's a lot of chatter now about what the Uberization of the economy and the workforce might do to us over time, where you've got jobs that might, in theory, provide more income, but they're not going to have benefits attached to them, so you have to go out into the marketplace to purchase those things. I mean, it's kind of a brave new world, is it not, Catherine?
Well, and I think...
Or scary new world.
It is a scary new world. The number of people who are working as, in a sense, entrepreneurs, but wage entrepreneurs, where you're not employed by a company, where you have a long-term history and there's going to be a pension for you at the end. You know, you might have some kind of way to invest your own money that will then grow maybe into a pension. But I think you're right that we're entering a world where, you know, somebody contracts with me as an independent contractor to do a certain job, and it's a time-limited job. And then when that job is up, I have to go find somebody else who will contract with me. And what people have said is that's not just, you know, the Uber driver, but it's white-collar people who have skills where we're not going to see the same kind of developing company loyalty, and therefore the company will take care of you in your retirement. That kind of security is gone in many cases.
We are talking about poverty and opportunity here on No Limits. This is part of what is going to be a continuing conversation called Chasing the Dream. It's a larger conversation that WFYI is in part of, that is a national conversation. We're going to do three more shows on this on June 16th, 21st, and 28th. My guests today are Catherine Byers, who's the former co-director of the Institute for Family and Social Responsibility at Indiana University, and Kelsey Clayton, who is manager of the Indiana Assets and Opportunity Network. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking about poverty and opportunity. This is part of a much larger conversation called Chasing the Dream. It's a national conversation that WFYI is part of and is going to be the subject of several more No Limits programs in the weeks ahead. My guests are Catherine Byers, who's retired from the IU School of Social Work and is the former co-director of the Institute for Family and Social Responsibility at IU, and Kelsey Clayton, who is manager of the Indiana Assets and Opportunity Network. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can do what a listener, also named Kelsey, has done, right, and send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Kelsey says, wonderful program. I heard one of your guests mention the statistic that we have 1 in 5 children living in poverty. And I am curious about this, as I know it negatively affects development and has many implications in our school systems and community. I often work with families in underprivileged areas, and I notice that a large population of them seem to have several children, not unplanned. I'm not sure if this large immediate family size is related to cultural norms, education level, or purely coincidence that I am seeing this trend. Do you know how family size varies between socioeconomic status? Thank you, and keep up the excellent work, the other Kelsey. So who would like that one first? Catherine?
I can say that, and I can't, I don't have the statistic in front of me, but we know, and this is true globally, okay, so it's not just Indiana, it's not just the United States, that as the status of women improves in a society, and as women have more assets, they limit family size. Mm-hmm. And that's why access to birth control and contraceptives are so important, particularly for women who may not be able to afford to go to a private doctor but need to go to a clinic for their health care, that it's very important that be available to women because as their assets increase, as they improve their condition economically, family size is limited. And I'm not sure of the dynamic of why that is. I just know that that's what happens.
How much of this is also a change sort of in the larger scale historic forces? I mean, in an agrarian economy, for example, a large family made a certain amount of sense because you had more people to work the farm. We're not as much of an agrarian economy as we once were, but we're only really a couple of generations away from that time. How long is there a lag often in sort of adjusting to what is this new reality, Catherine?
I don't know how long it is, but I think that you're right, and I think there also are some cultural norms as well in terms of when child mortality is high, you tend to see larger families because you want to ensure that some children survive. And if you look at our child mortality rate among low income and families of color, it's significantly higher within this country. As a matter of fact, in some communities, it's almost at a third world kind of rate of childhood mortality. So there is that kind of mechanism that may be operating as well.
Gotten a question from a listener who didn't want to go on the air. It says, please talk about the post-welfare reform shift to block grants and away from federal cash grants and some of the biggest and most significant impacts that has had on how social welfare programs are administered and also politicized. I heard snorts from both of you, so I'm going to give both of you a crack at that one. we'll start with Catherine, but I want to hear Kelsey's
Very good
thoughts,
point.
Too.
Very good point. Indiana, as an example, the cash benefit, I think this is for a mother and two children, in 1996 was $288 a month. The cash benefit for a mother and two children in 2016 is $288 a month. Now, we know that in those 20 years, some costs have increased, but we're still providing $288. And that's the maximum benefit, by the way. That's the maximum benefit. And we can have a long conversation about whether people could really survive on that, even with public housing and even with food stamps. So now I've lost track of my point. What was the question?
Well, it's really...
welfare reform, yeah. The shift. And so, yes, in fact, the shift has been away from giving people cash to providing services. This is not to put the services down, but job training services, various kinds of skill development, some support services, maybe a little bit more money sometimes in childcare. But Kelsey and I, before the show, were having a conversation about how important having a place to live is. Mm-hmm. That you can't, if you don't have a stable place to live, it's very hard to get the rest of your life together, whatever challenges you may face. And one of the things that we know about people who are at the very low income level is they move a lot, sometimes because they can't pay the rent. And so they move. That very, very frequently means children changing schools, mm-hmm. and disrupting their education. And so this giving less money to people, I think, I'm not sure why, whether that's a distrust of how people will spend the money, and putting more of the money in services. While the services may be good, if we're not providing adequate financial support for people, they're not going to be able to take advantage of the services.
And let me reframe it a little bit for you, Kelsey. When I bring, has there ever been any discussion that it sounds like this was framed as an either or? We either give them cash or we give them these services. Has there ever been any serious thought that maybe it should be a both and?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. A few things come to mind, too. With the Indian Assets and Opportunity Network, we work to eliminate asset limits. So, for instance, with the SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, you know, food stamp program, there is an asset limit. So, say a woman has, is on food stamps, and if a family has more than $2,250 in liquid savings, so it's cash savings, they are kicked off the SNAP program. So it's de-incentivizing people to save in order to get off because, the barriers that exist. You know, we think about township trustees and that sort of cash assistance. You know, unfortunately, they're often disconnected from the social service agencies, you know, to really, help families with cash assistance, but then also link them to the resources in their community. The Center for Working Families, for instance, is kind of a network of social service agencies that give that wraparound service. It's like financial coaching and counseling, job development, adequate resources for mental health issues, helping folks create a plan to move up that ladder. So I believe that there are resources in our community, but it's really, it's de-incentivizing folks in terms of our systematic progress and policy.
How much of this, too, because I'm thinking so much of what we thought of as welfare and many of our anti-poverty programs trace back to the New Deal and really the Great Depression, which in the popular mind I think often is thought of as an economic crisis, which it certainly was, but it was also a political crisis and at least part of a cultural one too, and at least part of the motivation behind the New Deal was to reassure people at some level, okay, there is a safety net. When you start falling, you're not just going to keep falling. There will be something there to catch you. It sounds like, from what I'm hearing, that if that safety net still exists, it's really badly tattered, and we're not willing to offer that kind of reassurance anymore. Catherine.
Well, I agree. I think it is badly tattered. We have some of the limits that Kelsey mentioned, so that you don't qualify if you make a dollar more than this, or if you have a car worth more than $500 or whatever the limit might be, and yet you need a car worth more in order to get to your job because there is no public transportation between where you live and where your job is. So there, we have a kind of a patchwork, if you will, of, you know, we have a supplemental food assistance program. We have a medical assistance program. We have that works for some people, but not everybody. We have some income assistance. We have the township trustee system that provides very, very temporary assistance. So we'll help you out with this month's rent, but, you know, not on a long-term kind of basis. So that what I think happens in this country is you can be thrown into poverty through no fault of your own. Mm-hmm. You lose a job. It's, you know, maybe when jobs aren't that easy to find. And so you're looking. You're looking for a job, but you're not finding something. There are a lot
like
of
the carrier folks here.
Right, exactly. There are a lot of middle-income people who are one check, paycheck away from poverty themselves. And I've talked to township trustees who have had to help middle-income, formerly middle-income people who have, you know, homes and but they can't pay the mortgage anymore because dad lost his job and he can't find another job. And if you've lost a good-paying job, it's going to be very hard for you to hire on at a fast food place. They're not going to hire you because they know as soon as you find a better-paying job, you're out of there. And so there's a spiraling kind of thing that happens. And we don't have a good net that really catches people as they spiral down from where they may have been to a point of poverty. And in fact, we penalize people. We had savings back 30 years. We had savings. My son was born prematurely. Mm-hmm. I had what I thought was good health insurance through IU, through being a student, that was taken up, you know, in this first month. We hit the maximum. And we had to spend down in order to qualify for Medicaid. We had to impoverish ourselves in order to qualify, because we had the foresight to have some savings. And so we have systems like that in this country that don't allow people to preserve whatever assets they had during a hard time. You have to spend those assets down.
In the name of attacking dependency, they actually create it at some level. We are talking about poverty and opportunity as part of an ongoing large conversation called Chasing the Dream here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, you do what a listener named Rob has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Rob, welcome to the program.
Hi, I appreciate you taking my call today.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
Well, I wanted to follow up on something the previous caller specifically talked about, value of the dollar. I look at it a little bit differently. I noticed that we have a real low savings rate. Yet there's so many businesses that have credit available. Now, it seems to me if we would tie our savings with our business loan, then there would be less opportunity for consumption. There would be more need to produce. It's pretty easy for a business to lay off workers when they don't need that worker's savings account at the local bank for their own credit. I think this is an important issue that the previous caller had talked about.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks very much for the call and for the point. Catherine, you're nodding your head, so I'll throw that one back to you.
I guess I'm not sure I completely understand if there was a question or if it was more of a statement. I think certainly we have a very low savings rate in this country. Part of it is we have very low interest rates on savings right now in this country. I remember when they used to be a bit higher, and so there was more incentive to save. And we also have an expectation that we will acquire things that are necessities now. I mean, it's very hard to look for a job and not have internet access now. And that costs money. It's very hard to look for a job and not have a cell phone now. So there are expenses related to looking for a job that mean that we buy services instead of saving that money that would help us. So it's I think, a very complicated kind of picture and makes it challenging for those who are trying to work their way out of poverty.
We've gotten a question that I think hits the nail on the head from a listener named Jen via Facebook, and you can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. Jen says, I think about everything that contributes to poverty and just wonder how I, an average U.S. citizen, can help to change the amount of people in poverty. What can I do to influence my fellow citizens' ability to get out of poverty? I just want to know how to help. Kelsey.
Hi, Jen. Thanks for your call. I think it very much is, we need to influence policy. That is the most important piece if we're really going to change these systems that aren't working for our Americans. So that's grassroots supports. That's getting involved with your local community organization that is discussing these issues. And then bringing your friends there and talking about it together and diving into these issues that are important to every person in America. I think that is, the grassroots support that we need.
Catherine.
I think I agree with Kelsey that's critical, influencing policy. Part of it, too, is putting a face on poverty. As one of the other callers said, we talk about these statistics and numbers of income, but what does it look like? And I think that's really helpful for us to see what it looks like and then to be able to convey to our friends, this is, I saw this family. This is what they look like. This is what they're struggling with. And you can do that there are lots of volunteer opportunities, I'm sure, here in Indianapolis, working with various food pantries, working with Hoosier Hills Food Bank and other kinds of organizations like that, working with, there are usually through the CAP agency, there's some kind of partnering with people who are trying to work themselves out of poverty. So there are lots of opportunities, sometimes through churches and synagogues, to get involved in some direct work. But I think the policy work is essential.
And that'll have to be the last word. I'd really like to thank my guests, Catherine Byers and Kelsey Clayton, particularly Catherine, who came in on her anniversary. We're going to talk about this more. So please join us. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Terzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.